Frail Chinchana Chen. Where do I stand? Like right in front of the pole? I can talk to the pole. Yeah. Connection lost. Just on time. Connection lost. Okay, we're going to try again. And it's going to find it. If not, I just walk back there and click the clicker every once in a while. Looking. Yeah, so my name is Rabbi Zvi Freeman. I'm a Reform rabbi. Welcome to the Reform Institute of Mayan Yisrael. And we are out to reform the entire world, or reconstruct the entire world, whichever way you want to put it. One thing we for sure are not, at least speaking for myself, is Orthodox. Orthodox is I find rather insulting. Well, I guess we took it on sort of like back at Woodstock, they were calling us hippie freaks. Okay, you want to call us hippie freaks? So we're hippie freaks. Okay. Orthodox is a similar sort of insult. I'll tell you where the word comes from. The first time we find Orthodox used about Jewish rabbis, it was when Napoleon Bonaparte decided that he has to organize his kingdom, the Republic, everybody has to have rights, the Protestants have to have their thing, the Catholics have to have their thing, and the Jews have to have their organized system. And so the rabbis, some of the rabbis in France says, yes, it's called the Sanhedrin. And he says, okay, call it whatever you want, just make it. And they wrote to the other rabbis and said, we're forming the Sanhedrin. Get this, Mashiach is here, we're forming the Sanhedrin. And other rabbis wrote back to them and says, this is a Mashiach, Sanhedrin, the little guy with his hand in his pockets, that's a Mashiach. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. And so they got a letter back from the progressive rabbis saying, you don't understand. The world is moving forward. There's progress. You people can't deal with progress. You can't deal with change. You're Orthodox. It was an insult. Ortho means straight, like orthopedist, right? And dox, like way of thinking. You have a straight way of thinking. You're stuck up, in other words. Right? I always felt the whole reason the Baal Shem Tov came to the world is to show you that you don't have to be stuck up to be from. Well, orthodox is about being, like, following the line. This is what everybody does. This is how things work. This is the way it's supposed to be. Don't step out of line. Status quo. So there are movements that say, you know, just be a good American, don't look different, don't act different than anybody else, let's try to fit in to our modern society. But us Torah observant Jews, we're out there to shake the whole thing up, to turn everything upside down. I'll give you some evidence that's what we're here for, okay? Let me ask you, the very first conception of the Jewish people, when we were conceived, okay, like the twinkling in the eye of the Jewish people, what would you say would be the event, the first conception of the Jewish people, the first event?
Circumcision of Abraham.
Circumcision of Abraham, but he's already 100 years old, well, 99, right? So that's kind of, I mean, he started his career before then, but Abraham is a good start, but where in Abraham's life would you start? Yeah, that sounds interesting. This is a picture from my Haggadah. So you've got this recalcitrant 14-year-old who's been left alone with his father in his father's idol department store. And he's supposed to take care of the idols and sell them and so on. And he's told that at lunch you have to feed all the idols. He's told that, you know, lunchtime you've got to put like a little pot of food in front of this idol, smaller pot, you know, bigger one in front of this one. The big one gets a big pot of food. You burn the incense, and then after an hour, you take it all away and throw it out. Right? And so, you know, his father's gone and everything, and he looks, and that's a lot of work to put this little measure it all out and everything. And he's looking at all these idols all around, wood, stone, bronze, whatever they are, and his twinkle in his eye. I got an idea. He takes all of the food, He puts it in one big bowl. He puts the big bowl of food in the lap of the big, big idol. Then, smiling, he goes back into the workshop and he comes out with a mallet. He takes the mallet, and I'm going to have fun now. And ka-bang, ka-boom, smashing everything. You did this when you were 14 years old, didn't you? Bang, smash, have a wonderful time. The wood iconoclast. That's exactly. He's the first iconoclast. Smash. The wood is splinters. The metal is smashed into distorted whatever they are, and anything that's made out of clay or anything else has shards all over the floor. It's a total disaster. It looks like a teenager just had a party. And when he's finished with the whole thing, he takes the mallet and puts it in the arms of the big idol. And just at that moment, who happens to walk in but his father, Terach? And his father, Terach, says, you heard this lecture before? What have you done to my idols? I mean, how much can you insure idols for, you know? What? And Avram answers, like a typical teenager, there you go again, Dad. Always blaming me. It's my fault right away. You don't even get to ask. I don't even get to say anything. Immediately, if something went wrong, it's his fault. Right? Right, Dad? And Terach says, you smashed my idols! My entire inventory! What have you done to it? And he says, Dad, just calm down and let me explain the whole thing. Look, right over there. Who's got the mallet? Me or him? Him, right? So let me explain to you. I was going about my business, putting the little bowl in front of this guy, the bigger bowl in front of that one, the medium, and this idol starts arguing with that idol and says, hey, how come you got a bigger bowl than me? And the other one says, well, you know, I'm more powerful than you. I may be smaller, but I'm more powerful because I'm fire and you're water. You know? No, yeah, but water can put out fire. And they start arguing with each other. And the other one says, hey, yeah, I should get both of their bowls because I'm smarter and I'm bigger and I'm more powerful than both. And they all start fighting with and hitting and slugging each other. And it's a whole big fight. And the big isle's waiting for his food. And he gets tired of this whole thing. So he went and got the mallet. He smashed them all to smithereens, took all of their food, put them in his bowl. And look. We caught him red-handed. Terach says, I don't know what you're talking about. They can't talk. They can't fight. They can't argue. You're making all this up. Avraham looks astonished at his father and says, so if so, Dad, why do you worship them? Now think of the psychology behind this. What's going on over here? What's going on over here? Did Terach ever worship idols?
No, he sold them.
What do you think? The people that bought them and everybody else, did they really worship idols? I doubt it. You can go to India today and check out for yourself. There's all sorts of idols and everything, but nobody really believes in them. Just like the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, they didn't really believe them. It was a cultural thing that you did, and you went through this whole thing.
Like
Santa Claus. Yeah, and you had this idol, and just in case you had another idol and another idol. Nobody really believed it because nobody really thought about it. There was one person who really worshipped idols, and that was Avraham. When he was a little kid, he got excited about all these idols, and he was asking people, so what does this one do? And what does that idol do? And they said, well, this one's fire, this one's water. Okay, so if the two of them meet, like, which one's going to win? You know, like, he thought the whole thing's like Dungeons and Dragons type of thing. So, and they would tell him, well, this one could win. So which one's more powerful? I want to know which one's more powerful. The kid just go through the rituals like everybody else. You don't have to ask all these questions. No, I need to know, like, which one's like, I want the most powerful of all of them. And they told him, well, the most powerful one is the sun. He says, yeah, that makes sense. The sun is the most powerful one. And he stays up the whole night waiting for the sun to rise. And he's there in the desert, and he watches the sun come up. And he's dancing and singing to the sun. Wow, the sun is so powerful. Everything comes to life from the sun, the warmth of the sun, the light of the sun. It's everything. The sun is everything. Wow, and he's dancing and singing for 6 hours until he notices after 6 hours that the sun is going down. And he thinks, yeah. That was stupid of me. The sun goes down. And eventually it sets. And if so, it's not all powerful. So this is how it goes. I didn't make this up. Rabbi Dov Ber of Lubavitch, the second Rebbe of Chabad, he states this. He says, Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, was the first person to realize on his own that all this stuff is fake. Why? Because he was the first person to really do it, to really think about it, to really get into it. In his words, he was a bar da'at, a bar das. He thought about it. He was obsessed with it to the point that he realized it's nonsense. It was had to be for real for him. Everything was for real. So this really is the conception of the Jewish people, is a 14-year-old recalcitrant kid smashing the idols, the first iconoclast, smashing the idols in his father's home. If you would ask him at that point in time or any other point in time, Abraham, are you Orthodox? Orthodox, he'd say. Orthodox? I'm a radical. I'm a rebel. I'm a revolutionary. I'm trying to change the entire world. The whole world's going this stupid way, following Nimrod, worshiping him and worshiping all his idols, and he's got them under his thumb, controlling everybody. And I'm telling them, you can run your own lives. You can worship the one God, creator in heaven and earth. And he cares about every human being, and he listens to each one of you. I'm going to turn the entire world upside down. Orthodox? Nimrod is Orthodox. I'm a revolutionary. And that's how the Jewish people began. Now, I wanted to show you something else, but I can't while this slideshow is showing, because I didn't get the actual movie of it yet. But I'll show it to you over here. Oh, here we go. Do we have that on the screen? Okay, now I just got to get it to play. That's the hard part.
Hi, I'm Pharaoh, and I'm Moses. Today I will be talking to you about power, information, and nation management. Information is power, and that's how you manage a nation. Right on! Control information, and you control the people. Distribute information, and you empower the people. Which would be reckless and irresponsible. Why? Because then they would start asking nudnik questions like, why? What's so bad about that? What's so bad about that? Questions are destabilizing. The only way to maintain a stable, sustainable society is through a pyramid structure of knowledge. The common people, down here, ignorant and obedient. Useful civil servants here, with just the information they require. The priesthood, scientists, and techies above them, with enough knowledge to mystify everyone else. And up here, Pharaoh himself, that's me. Sort of like the cosmic order. God on top, angels below. Then lower angels, then people, animals, etc. Exactly. So if you spread knowledge everywhere, that would subvert the whole thing. Exactly. So let's do that. Why would you do that? Those questions coming, Pharaoh. I would do that because God is everywhere. So truth has to be everywhere. So this structure is obviously only a temporary measure designed to be subverted. And just how do you propose to run a nation if not modeled on the cosmic pyramid? We're doing it. I took all the people to a big mountain and stood on top of the mountain and proclaimed, I am your prophet. Yes, it's been done before. Not quite. We arranged for everyone to hear God speaking directly, no intervention. You're nuts. You've relinquished all your power over them. And just now, we've released the hardware that seals the deal. Lugos 2.0. Yes, because 1.0 suffered a fatal crash, right? Admit. Lugos 2.0 is our most robust hardware yet, due to our cutting-edge function called forgiveness. Next, we've got a mobile tabernacle for the people on the go in the works. Open source, full disclosure of all the priestly rights. We've even got a simplified 22-letter phonetic alphabet, so that every child can learn to read. Cute, Moses, very cute. Now let me tell you something. The pyramids of Egypt will last forever.
Okay, quit that. Back to the show here. Oh, gotta find me again. Okay. So Moses starts off his career as a civil rights leader, killing a brutal Egyptian taskmaster. And then he runs off. Come on, you can find that device. He runs off to Midian, where he becomes a woman's rights leader because he saves Yisro's daughters from the shepherds, and it goes on from there. He comes back, and at least according to I think the movie was just released on Saturday, also makes him into a revolutionary. But the ideas of Moses were again extremely revolutionary. Well, like some of the ideas I was trying to present in the 3 minutes that I get on my tiny budget, shoestring budget over there. What's Moses telling Pharaoh that's so revolutionary to Pharaoh? That basically you can run a country, you can run a nation by empowering the people, which was the opposite of the way that empires were being formed at the time in the ancient world, the age of empires. How did you control people? By controlling information, right? China is still doing that. To a degree, some other countries that are more familiar. Okay, so by controlling information. And Moses is saying, no, we're going to distribute information. Very fascinating thing. I lost my connection again. Very fascinating thing. The first instance we found to date of a phonetic alphabet. Well, it's called a phonetic alphabet because the Greeks said it came from Phoenicia, and that was what people believed for a long time, that came from Phoenicia. And then eventually we found the first traces of the phonetic alphabet in caves in the Sinai Peninsula. And it turns out that the original Hebrew alphabet, 22 letters, is the prototype of every alphabet that exists today. That's where it comes from, just 22 letters. But then something more fascinating. Everybody thinking, like, doesn't it make sense? It's so simple, such an idea. If you want to write, just come up with a small set of letters, and these letters will represent sounds. And those sounds, you can put them together and make words because our words are made of sounds, right? So it should make a lot of sense. Why did the Egyptians and the Sumerians, and we work with these glyphs instead, and in China they had glyphs, and everybody's working with all these pictures. You had to memorize in ancient Egypt like hundreds and hundreds of glyphs and a whole coding system in order to be able to write, like in Chinese to this day. Well, it turns out the ancient Egyptians had phonetics. When they wanted to write the name of something that was foreign to them, they used phonetics. So if they had the phonetics, why didn't they just throw out all the glyphs and just use the phonetics? So Claude Lévi-Strauss, the anthropologist, says that's a stupid question. The whole point of writing in the ancient world was to control people. And how did you control people? Through secrecy. You wrote something down because it was supposed to be secret. You didn't want the common people to read it.
You had a linguistic aristocracy.
Exactly. Aristocracy through linguistics, right? What Moshe Rabbeinu is coming along telling us, everybody has to write a Sefer Torah. First of all, everybody has to be there at Mount Sinai. That's totally radical. Totally radical. You want only the priestly caste to be there. You want one. Nobody else in the whole of history does this. You have one person comes back and says, God spoke to me. Not to you. God spoke to me. So you got to listen to me. Moses says, hey, people, I heard from God. I want all of you to come and hear from him firsthand. And when the people come to Moses and say, no, we can't handle this. Like, this is too much. We're just blowing our souls away each time. Moses is very disappointed. He wants everybody to hear directly from God. And he wants then everybody to have their copy of the Torah that they'll write and they will learn from. It's empowering the people. What's the most radical book of the five books of Torah? In a way, it's Vayikra, Leviticus. Why? Because in Vayikra it's called Toras Kohanim. It's a book, most of it is the priestly rites. Tumah v'Tahara, what makes you pure, what makes you impure, how are you supposed to do things in the temple, and so on. If you would show this book to any priests, not just in the times of Moses, but for in the next several thousand years until the Reformation, this is ridiculous. You can't let everybody know what are the priestly rites. How will you mystify the people? You're going to let some five-year-old kid say, Daddy, that priest's not doing it right. But that's exactly what Moses wanted. He wanted to empower the people by distributing information, distributing knowledge. Knowledge should be everywhere. Which is a revolutionary step. Okay, but there are many other revolutionary things in the Torah and that affected society throughout. Slowly, 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 society, the Roman Empire became Judaized and things changed, okay? But I want to give a few examples. Most of them from really the 17th century. The 17th century was really the Hebrew, the Jewish century. When did the 17th century begin? Began well belong before the year 1600, but it's a long century. But it's a time, basically, when the Bible was finally in the vernacular. Now you're going to think, well, until the 17th, the way I was taught history, all of us are taught history, was that the Dark Ages, all people had was just the Bible and religion, and nobody thought for themselves. And then finally, they rejected the church, and people started free thinking, and then they came up with democracy and rights of the people and Voltaire and the French Revolution and so on. That's a myth. Not it's a myth, it's a lie. And it's very easy to disprove. You can go and take whatever books were written, whatever works, even of theology, that were written pre-17th century, and take an index them. See what their sources are. The sources are Aristotle, Alexander, Plato, and so on. The Greeks, Romans, Cicero, and so on. A little bit of Bible here and there, and the Bible is only brought about salvation, and spiritual matters, and that's it. Suddenly in the 17th century, take any books, whether it be Locke or Hobbes, or whoever it is, and the vast 75-90% of the sources are going to be from the Bible. And all of a sudden people are discussing, how do you run a country according to the Bible? I'll give you a good example. The first regicide in history, the first time that the people decided that a king was to be punished. Maybe you know this incident. Come on, slide. Oh, no, wrong slide. Back. There he is. Okay, that's Charles I being beheaded. The Parliament in England sat and decided that the king had disobeyed the law several times. He did not listen to Parliament, and he was breaking the law. And so ensued a whole discussion. Can a king be punished? Well, according to Roman law, British, so on, the tradition was that kings ruled by divine right. They represented God. They could do whatever they wanted. They were above the law. They could change the law. But John Selden, who was the scholar, stood up in Parliament, and he says, but in the book of Deuteronomy, it says that the king must have the law with him wherever he goes and read from it day and night. And based on this, the rabbis of the Talmud, he said that the king can be punished. And Maimonides, based on the Talmud, he knew all the stuff backwards and forwards, therefore rules that if a king disobeys the law, he can be punished by the Supreme Court, which is basically us. And so they beheaded King Charles. First time in history such a thing happened. The king was beneath the law. If that surprises you that John Selden knew so much of Torah, you should look at the works of Sir Isaac Newton, where he quotes not just the Bible and Maimonides, but Rashi and Sifra and Sifri and Talmud Bavli and Rishalmi and Adon Yitzhak of Abarbanel and so on in his writings. Backwards and forwards, these people knew it all. Yitzhak Newton. Yeah. He spent more time, much more of his writings, writing about the Bible and the Talmud and so on than he did writing about mathematics and physics and anything else. He had a chest. When he died, his family asked a bishop to look through this chest, all these writings, and see if there's anything they can sell to make some money off of this. The bishop opened the chest, started reading some of it, his face went white, threw the books back in, slammed it, and locked it shut, and said, "Nothing in here worth anything. Don't even open it." It wasn't until the 20th century, I think in the 1920s, that the manuscripts were sold, and it turns out that he's quoting mostly Maimonides, some Zohar. He has his copy of the Zohar in there. It's on display in the British Museum. And no, he's not Jewish, but people were fascinated with anything Hebrew and anything Jewish. As they said, "Listen, we're reading the Bible now. We can't understand it. The only resource we have, even though we don't like them, is the rabbis. So we'll go to the rabbis to explain it to us." And he was writing to other scholars in Europe that we should set up a system of international law based on the seven laws of Noah, Noahide laws. Yeah, he rejected the Trinity and was basically a Maimonidean. And that's why the bishop was so stunned by this whole thing. And many other intellectuals of the time, that's what was influencing. Okay. There's so many things I could bring up. I'll bring up John Locke because whenever we talk about social welfare, which is a major issue in our society today, which means that there's this revolutionary idea that if somebody doesn't have, you are obligated to give to them. This is different than charity. It doesn't mean that you're being nice. It means you're obligated. That the government can tax you, take money from you, to give to somebody who does not have. Now, something had to happen before that. First of all, it had to be recognized that people could own property. Now, we take that for granted. You have property. But for most of history, people didn't really have property. The only people who had property were the kings, nobility, and the clergy. And everybody else were basically serfs, slaves, and so on. And whatever you had really didn't belong to you. The king could come and take it at any time. Nothing was really yours. You did not belong to yourself. During the times of the Roman Empire, the Roman Empire became Judaized, and they got this idea that people could own property. But it came once again into a fore, again, after the Reformation, and people started reading the Bible, and they read, wow, in the ancient Hebrew system of the Bible, the way God sets things up, everybody has their plot of land. And nobody can take that plot of land away from you, not even the king. Like the story of when Achav wanted to take the vineyard of Nevot, and he could not do that. He's not allowed to do that. That's an amazing idea. That means that the way to run a country is everybody must own their own property. And it was called a commonwealth. The famous book, Atlantis, discussing how you run a country with everybody has to be landed, own property. So now everybody owns property. Amazing thing, amazing idea. And that was really a foundational idea, the fathers of the American Revolution. We'll get to them later. But once it was decided that, yes, you can own property, and the king has no right to take that away from you, right, arbitrarily, right? If it's in need of war, he has to pass through a line of battle, or he's making a tax over everybody. But I'm taking your property. No, I can't do that because it belongs to you. People own property. They got that from the Torah, right? From the whole idea of Shemitah and Yovel and so on. That's where it came from. So after that came this idea of social welfare. And John Locke basically said that God leaves nobody to be starving. And God in his Bible said that if one man is hungry and another man has surplus, the one with surplus must give to the man who does not have.
Not can choose.
No, not choose, but he must give. And therefore, The government has the right to take from the person who has surplus to give to the person who is starving. And his source from this, all he says, was God says in his Bible. And scholars have always searched for where does God say this in his Bible and so on, and they point to Luke or wherever, but it doesn't say anywhere in the Christian Bible. The only source for legislated social welfare is, again, in the five books of Moses. That's where it's from. First of all, you have to leave a corner of your field. You have to give tithes to the poor. And there's something called tzedakah, which does not mean charity. It means what is proper and right. If a person is hungry, you have to give to him. You must. It's legislated social welfare. So wherever you see an institution of social welfare, any discussion of socialism, non-socialism, that's where it comes from. That's where it was originally brought up, because all historians trace it back to John Locke, and John Locke got it from there. Connection lost again. What's with this thing? Okay. The two most enlightened nations in the 17th century were the Netherlands and England. And the reason was basically because that's where everybody was, all the radicals were running to. You were running away from the terrible wars in Germany, the religious wars in Germany. You were running away from the religious oppression in France and Italy and elsewhere. Where did you run to? You ran to the Netherlands or you ran to England. And so all these free thinkers ended up in those lands, or in Switzerland as well. Okay, so in the Netherlands, they tried to form a government without a king, based again on the Hebrew Commonwealth and so on. But the Netherlands and England also were very wealthy, and they were colonializing. And they found themselves coming into conflict in Southeast Asia and India and elsewhere, where the British were conquering and colonializing, and the Dutch were colonializing and so on. They were in conflict with each other. And they said, this is no good. This is total chaos. We have to have international law. So we'll take a Dutchman, the most brilliant of Dutchmen at the time. They considered Hugo Grotius. And we'll take an Englishman. His name was John Selden. I mentioned him before. We'll put the two of them together, and they'll come up with international law. And so Hugo Grotius said, well, peace and harmony between nations is not possible without a common ground and common authority. We need a common authority. So let's look for some sort of precedent over there. The only common authority, he says, could be God. Where do we find something in the Bible where there's some idea of international law? Guess where they found it? There's an institution in the Torah called a ger toshav. A ger toshav means somebody who does not adopt your religion, but he abandons idolatry. He's willing. He keeps the seven laws of Noah, and so therefore he lives to get in peace with you. And you must support him. If he's in need, you have to give to him. And you can't make war with him. If any nation accepts the seven laws of Noah, you can't make war with them. You have to be at peace with them. So the way Hugo and John understood this was that there's religious law and there's civil law. The laws of Noah are civil law. This person is not accepting your religious law, but he's accepting your civil law. So therefore, any nation that accepts that basic civil law, we can't go to war with, unless they attack us first, of course. But if they don't keep that civil law, which includes believing in one God, because if you don't have one God, you don't have one law. Makes sense, right? So you have to have only one God and not be idolaters. Okay, then we have peace with each other. And based on that, we founded international law. To this day, the International Law Society is called the Grotius Society, after Hugo Grotius. The Grotius, G-R-O-T-I-U-S. The British were delighted with this idea because it allowed them to continue having wars with the French, who they hated so much, because the French were Roman Catholics and they decided that Roman Catholicism is idolatry. It's very convenient for them. And the British and the Dutch were able to get along, finally. I want to read a lot more of this. There's an amazing book by a professor of government at Harvard, Eric Nelson. And he wrote a book, The Hebrew Republic, not long ago. He had originally wrote a book, The Greek Republic. In the book, The Greek Republic, his thesis was that the 17th century was when we moved from thinking in Roman terms to thinking in Greek terms. After about a year or so, he chucked that out and realized it's all wrong. And really, it's when we moved from Greek and Roman thinking to Hebrew thinking. And he goes through how all the basic foundations of the modern state were formed directly from the Hebrew Bible, according to rabbinical commentary. The way they, not necessarily the way that we understand it, but the way they understood it for their convenience. And the experiment began in England and then moved to America, in England and Holland, and then moved there to America. So let's get what happens in America. Everybody knows the fathers of the American Revolution of Independence. Many of them were able to read Hebrew fluently. They studied many Hebrew books. They were very influenced by Hebrew writings, because you can see from the dollar bill. Well, I just want to show you the original draft of the Declaration of Independence. This is basically Thomas Jefferson's writing, and we figure most or all of those edits seem to be in the handwriting of Benjamin Franklin. When in the course of human wants and so on, it becomes necessary for when people get... And then we get to this point where we hold these truths to be... Look at that. Elsewhere, you see like lines put through the words. Over here, all of a sudden, instead of lines put through the words, you see these violent slash, 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 thick slashes. Like somebody got very angry over there. And instead of, we hold these truths to be something, 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 that all men are created equal. He put, we hold these truths to be self-evident. What was written inside here beforehand? We find these truths to be sacred and eternal. That all men are created equal. Now given that, that gives us, helps us a little bit. Tell me, logically, rationally, does the line as now edited by Benjamin Franklin, does it make sense? Is it self-evident that all men are created equal?
No.
Where is the evidence? At the millennium, the year 2000, the United Nations asked the International Society of Anthropologists to write up a document stating that we, as anthropologists, scientists, say that all human beings are really one race and we are all equal. And they were unable to do that. You can read the document. It's full of, if some people could agree and it can't be disproven and so on. But you can't. In what way are we equal? Some are taller, some are shorter, right? Some are brighter, some are less. Some are good at this, some are good at that. And once you start measuring intelligent quotient, the IQ of people, so in some places they seem to be lower, in some places higher. Okay, after a few generations, things could change and so on. But you know, the guy who wrote the bell curve, right?
He got in a lot of trouble,
but he put Caucasians in the middle and Asians smarter than them and Jews higher, right? So, in what way are we equal? There's only one source for the idea that we are all equal. There's no tradition anywhere in the world, in China, in India, to this day in China. Human beings are not human beings until you grow older and you have some wisdom or some power, and that's what gives you worth. You have no worth just from being born, right? And the same thing, in ancient Greece, a child was born. The child's worthwhile? Good. Child's not worthwhile? Throw him in the garbage, literally. There's only one source in all of human literature for all people. That human life is of value, has dignity, and is sacred. And we're all from one human being, and that's from Torah. Because Benjamin Franklin slashed out those words and instead put in self-evident, he gave a possibility for what happened in basically the 19th century, something called social Darwinism, when people said, well, you know, they said like this, before the Civil War, they said, we've enslaved these black people. Now, if all people are equal and all descended from Adam, then it's totally unjustifiable that we've enslaved these people. So, therefore, it must be that people are not equal. That's a solution. And maybe they're not descended from Adam, and maybe there is no Adam, and so on. And then finally comes along Charles Darwin and gives, justification. Yes, there are people who are more evolved, people who are less evolved, and social Darwinism. Until by the 1920s, I think it was 1910, a professor, president of the American Society of Scientists declared that we have to tread over these ancient bones of these ancient notions of human equality, like all the ancient bones of the past. You know, these are biblical myths that people used to believe. But science had already established that some people are more equal than others. No, some people are people and some people are not people, that's all. And that's why they were able to make a quota to say only so many Poles, so many Italians, and very few Jews can be allowed into our country because they are mentally inferior. Jews were considered to be mentally inferior. We're not all equal. Throw this out. Who brought back human rights? Bible-thumping Baptists and outraged post-Holocaust Jews. The civil rights movement was a Bible-driven movement. It's a beautiful documentary on King and Heschel. They're very close, Martin Luther King and Yeshua Heschel. The guy interviews people who were very close with Martin Luther King. And they all said, we all carried around a book of the prophets. Not the prophets, Heschel's book, the prophets. And every time you hear Martin Luther King quoting the prophets, it's from Heschel. You'll find it there in Heschel. Right? That was his inspiration. Later afterwards, the left jumped in and it became a liberal left this thing to do. But if you were a leftist, a Marxist or whatever, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you were a racist. If you were an intellectual, educated person who rejected Christianity and the Bible and so on, you were a racist. Civil rights movement that's given everybody equal opportunity today is based on the Bible. As Jews understand it. As is America. Okay, I got lots of other examples that I could give, but tonight is the Siyum HaRambam. We have there's a one-year cycle where you do three chapters of the Rambam a day, or you can do one chapter and finish in 3 years, or you can just learn through the Sefer HaMitzvahs, and you learn the entire Torah according to the Rambam, which is an amazing thing. You get a bird's eye view of the entire Torah. It just happens to be tonight, so I want to bring up the Rambam over here. And the Rambam, you remember, this is a book, like he says, of halachos halachos, laws. This is the book of law. And anything that's in there, he's saying, he's leaving out all the discussion of the law, he's leaving out all the stories behind it, leaving out all that. This is just law. That's it. This is Jewish law. So is the definitive work of what is Jewish practice, what is Jewish belief, and so on. It's like that definitive word. This is the very last halacha in the Rambam. Remember, this is not a prophecy, that is not a drasha, it's not a sermon, it's a halacha in the Rambam. And he reserves it for the very last halacha. He says in that era, he's talking about the times of Mashiach, there will be neither famine or war, envy or competition. For good will flow in abundance, and all the delights will be freely available as dust. I think at that point we're there already. At least the kids in school have them. The occupation of the entire world will be solely to know God. Therefore, the Jews will be great sages and know the hidden matters, grasping the knowledge of the Creator according to the full extent of human potential. As it says in Yeshaya, Mal ha'aretz deyas Hashem kemayim liyam mechasim. The world be full of knowledge of God as the waters cover the earth. And he's talking about all human beings. The entire world will be filled with the knowledge of God as waters cover the ocean bed. So the question gets asked, beforehand, Maimonides has already told you all the laws of the temple in Jerusalem. Like in the middle of the book, he's gotten to there already, the middle of it. And all the laws, all sorts of other laws that only apply when the Jews are all in the land of Israel, Shemitah, Yovel, all these things, told you all these things. So really, he should have told you the laws of kings and told you about Mashiach and all that before he gets to the laws that apply when that will be. And that's going to happen. And even those who theorize that the Rambam felt that Mashiach's going to happen in his times, because he's living there in Alexandria, and all that had to happen was the Sultan of Egypt would just have to conquer the Ottoman Empire and take over, and then he would be viceroy and he would be appointed, and you know, the whole thing could happen naturally. Some theorize that's why he was writing all these laws that only pertain in the times of Mashiach. But he should have told you all about Mashiach first, and then tell you, and now when it's going to happen, we're going to be building this temple, and this is what we're going to have to do in this temple. But he leaves the laws of Mashiach for his conclusion of his work. And I'll tell you why. Because the way Maimonides looks at Judaism is very, very different. I would say the opposite from how Jews today look at Judaism. Today we look at Judaism something like keeping a brain-dead grandfather on life support. We have to preserve the ancient traditions of our forefathers. Jewish continuity. It would be so sad if it all went away. That's about it. The Rambam, as did Avraham Avinu, as did Moshe Rabbeinu, as did Rabbi Akiva, as did the Arizal, the Baal Shem Tov, all great leaders, understood what is Judaism, what is Torah. It's something here to change the world and bring us towards the future. It's not about the past. It's about the future. Yes, you have to have a past. You need a past. Because the only way that there's a sustainable future is that it has deep roots in the past. You want to, like a giant sequoia, has very, very deep roots. You want to build a very tall structure. You have to build a deep foundation. You want to push a heavy boulder? Make sure you've got solid ground under you before you start pushing. So we have traditions, and we have to study our traditions and know them well. We have to be very, very attached to our past in order to create a future. Because as we've seen, the only true, real, authentic, good change that has happened in the world that's been sustainable was all based on ancient tradition, going all the way back to the Torah. When the French attempted a revolution based entirely on human reason, it was a total disaster. And when the same thing happened in Russia, based on Marx's reasoning, and Marx, every intellectual understood Marx must be right, it's so reasonable, it makes perfect sense that the proletariat will arise with their tools, they'll take over the world, they'll share all wealth equally, and there will be peace throughout the entire world. It makes perfect sense. That sounds totally absurd, but it made perfect sense to everybody then. And any sort of change that happened in the world like that, based on human reason, was a failure. What happened in Britain, what happened in the Netherlands, and especially what happened here in America, was based on the Bible, was based on Torah, was based on tradition, and therefore it's sustainable. And I'll tell you one thing that's very disappointing to me. Growing up in Vancouver, I was very much a part of the environmental movement, forming Greenpeace and all those things. And as far as I can see today, the environmental movement is a total failure, an abysmal failure. We're still driving fossil-fueled cars in the streets. It doesn't make any sense. The only places where environmental movement has been successful is where somebody can make a buck off of it. And it was totally off the radar in the last two elections in America. Why is that? Because they built the environmental movement on rejection. Rejectionism, rejecting the past. They blamed all of pollution and the rape of the environment on the Judeo-Christian ethic, and then they tried to base environmentalism on paganism or on the Native Americans, and that totally did not work because the worst environmentalists were the people, were the First Nations people who lived here. So none of that worked. If they had come to America and said, these are the values of the Bible, these are American values, these are tradition, we have to go back to our tradition, we would be living in a much healthier world today. Maybe they'll still catch up to it at some point. So we have tradition in order to move forward. And every halacha of the Torah is, this is the way the world is now, this is the way the world has to be. How does the world have to be? That the entire occupation of the entire world is to know God, which means to know the oneness of the entire creation, the beauty and the harmony of the creation. And everything that we do as Jews, whether it's keeping Shabbos and letting the whole world know we're keeping Shabbos, lighting a menorah and letting the entire world see the light of that menorah, keeping kosher and letting the whole world know we believe eating is sacred, and the way you consume, whatever you consume, is a divine act. Letting the world know we're proud to be Jews. The life is centered around bringing up good kids, family values, letting the world know that the world is about kindness. Those Jewish values, I tell everybody, we have a huge number of non-Jews visiting Chabad.org. I don't know the figures for this year yet, but in 2013, we had 37 million unique visitors. So, okay, so there's 15 million Jews, that makes another, how many, 22 million non-Jews? Okay, so we get an awful lot of non-Jews coming there because they want to know what Jews have to say. Want to know what are Jewish values. So, there was a time we had to hide. They were after us when they hated us. Today they respect us. And they especially respect a Jew who acts like a Jew. And they want to hear from us. And they want to be told, like the Rebbe said, if you meet a non-Jew, you have a non-Jewish neighbor, you have to tell him, since you were created in the image of God, therefore you need to keep his rules, you need to keep his laws. You have to do what is right. You have to do what is good. It's an amazing thing. I remember I was standing there, I was a student studying in New York. It was 1981, 82. And I heard the Rebbe say that, you know, you have a neighbor who's not Jewish, you have to talk to him and tell him about, you know, not stealing, acting like a creature that's created in the image of God. And if you don't speak English, find somebody to translate. And we're living in New York, and you have to understand, it was a real dangerous place. You really didn't want to talk to those neighbors. And I didn't see any Lubavitch. Everything else the Rebbe said, people ran to do. But this, whoa, just hold on a minute. Over 20 years later, we hear from Jeffrey Davis. Jeffrey Davis was a black kid growing up in Brooklyn Avenue with his older brother, James Davis. He was 10, his brother was 12. And he said, we'd be playing ball outside, and the rabbi would walk by. And we would look forward to seeing this rabbi, because, for one thing, he gave us dollar bills. And then he would teach us things. And he'd tell us about being good people. One time he came back, my brother and I, we were fighting over the ball. And the rabbi said to us, don't fight with your brother. You have to love your brother as yourself. You have to love yourself, and you have to love your brother as yourself, and don't fight. And we listened to him. What happened? James Davis, the older brother, went off to study at Stony Brook. One night in the middle of the night, he was jumped on by some cops, beaten up badly. At that point, he decided he's going to, changing his career, he's going to become a police officer. When he graduated from police school, they made him an instructor to teach police officers how to deal with their communities. He got on the radio, and he and his brother, James and Jeffrey, started a movement called Love Yourself, Stop the Violence, based on the Rebbe's words. James Davis was probably the only person to get onto New York City Council by popular vote alone. He had no big backing from any corporation or anything. It was all from his radio show and popular vote. He got there onto City Council. And the guy who pushed off of City Council shot him dead right there in City Hall. They said James had his pistol in his pocket because he was a police officer. He could have pulled it out and shot back, but he chose not to. Okay? Two kids' lives that were totally changed because a rabbi happened to be a Lubavitcher Rebbe took the time off to talk to them, give him a dollar bill, and teach them. So I have these dollar bills, and I take them with me, and I talk to somebody who's not Jewish. I say, here's a dollar bill. Find somebody who needs it. They think that's a fantastic idea. That's good. And the amazing thing about it is, if I were a pastor, God, or a reverend, or something like that, they probably wouldn't want to listen to me because they think he's proselytizing. But I'm a rabbi. They know I'm not proselytizing. I'm not trying to convince them to become Jewish. And they're coming to our site. Why are they coming to Chabad Adar? We write, you know, they ask all sorts of questions. And we say, well, why don't you ask your reverend, ask your pastor? Ask my reverend, my pastor. He writes to you with his questions. You're the people of the book. What are you talking about? Okay, we are here to change the world. This is the time that people are ready to listen. They want to hear the depths of Torah. They want to hear what it's all about. Maimonides put it as this is eventually where all of halacha goes. He didn't describe it. Last week I was talking about how through tikkun we're able to actually change the world. And I want to show you a nice little Kabbalah tune here.
You see, I was imagining a perfect world on the Isafire, and I got so excited and kaboom! No, Fievel, that doesn't make me a schlamazel. Why, the infinite existifier of all things himself made a much bigger kaboom. That's right, when the infinite light first emanated forth, he generated an ideal world for infinite wisdom, kindness, strength, and beauty. Children sharing their toys, rabbis making sense, and vacuuming carpets. But then, just when it was supposed to become real, the whole thing was a breeze. There was just too much light for reality to handle. That's how we got this fragmented world we're in. Everything here is an artifact of some spark of truth that fell from that original ideal world. And guess what we put here and put the pieces back together? Want to join us? We're our very last pieces. Oh yes, Fievel, that goes right here.
Thank you. Probably be some questions. If people could leave, there's also some books back there. Thank you, everybody, for guiding me. Anybody have some challenges, questions, insults, whatever they are? Now's your chance. Okay, everything made sense? That's it.
That's a good talk.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that your voice on these?
Sorry?
Is that your voice on these cartoons?
No, that's Andrew Torres. He's a Puerto Rican who does traffic announcements from a helicopter over the Bronx. And he plays Rabbi Infinity in Kabbalah tunes. Yeah, he did Paro and Ari, all of them. In Kabbalah tunes, you'll find there Miri. Miri's my daughter. That's her voice. Yeah, but we're actually this week we're going to release our 100th Kabbalah tune. Yeah. So, and then 101. Yeah, so there's lots of that. So, now, like everything, just like, yeah, questions, yeah?
You started talking about Orthodox and the meaning of Orthodox, and then you came to the point that there's no such thing as right, because then you talk about Abraham, that how Abraham became a revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is no such a thing as Orthodox.
Well, there are Orthodox people that just do things because that's the way everybody else is doing it. I would say there's a type of person, there's a type of person who is a religious person because they have a personality that they don't like to step out of line, and that's it. This is the way I was brought up, this is the way it's taught in my community, this is how everything is done, and so therefore I do things this way as well. But I don't think that's what Judaism, Torah is about. Torah is about that you do these things out of love of God and because there's a purpose and meaning to life. And so we have to get out of just doing it out of habit. The Orthodox Jew, when you have four children at the Seder, the Orthodox one is a child who does not know how to ask a question. He's a grown-up person. He has a brain. He thinks. He may be very successful at what he does. But when anybody asks at the Seder, why do we do this? Why do we do that? He says, what do you say, why? It's because it says in the Haggadah to do it. Right? So the Chochem, the wise son, is the one who knows how to ask a good question. And the entire Haggadah is what kind of a question? It's a question about freedom. And where the Jewish people are going to, and where the world is going to. So that's what we're really about. It says a Torah Jew is somebody who does his mitzvahs with kavana, with meaning to it, and it has purpose. It's going somewhere.
So we shouldn't use Orthodox.
I really don't like the term we're stuck with. I mean, somebody's going to ask you, you know, whatever. Sometimes you have to use it out of formalities. I really don't like the term. Some people come up with other classic Judaism or observant Judaism. You know what term I like best? Jewish. That's it. My wife once had an interview for a community school, Jewish community school. So, you know, everybody sent their kids. This was in Vancouver. And at the time, the entire Hong Kong was moving to Vancouver. So where were they moving to? They were moving to the areas where the Jewish people lived. So your kid was going to a class where everybody's Chinese except for your kid. So all the Jewish community was dying. We got to put our kids inside Vancouver Talmud Torah, the Jewish schools. It was growing by leaps and bounds. And next thing you know, Vancouver Talmud Torah is getting phone calls from Hong Kong. I want to put my child in your school. I understand. Why do you want to put your child in our school? You're not Jewish, you're Chinese. Oh, we here, Vancouver, Tamato, very good school, very good school. Okay. So my wife gets an interview to teach in the school. They need more teachers. But they're very concerned. She's obviously Orthodox, you know. So they ask her some questions. So they ask her, if a child will ask you, describe to us the three main Jewish type movements, three types of Jews, kinds of Jews. So how would you describe it? Well, she said, there are three kinds of Jews. There are Jews who do mitzvahs. They're waiting. Then there are Jews who do more mitzvahs. And the third one, those are Jews who do even more mitzvahs. They said, well, what about Jews who don't do mitzvahs? She's just walking down the street and breathing. He's doing a mitzvah. How can they not do a mitzvah? Where did you see a Jew who's not doing a mitzvah? It's impossible. Okay. So labels are for shirts. Okay. We're just Jews. That's it. Period. We're all Jews. Let's get rid of all the labels. Maybe you can say this is a Reform temple. This is a conservative temple or synagogue. This is an Orthodox one, whatever. But the Jews themselves, you can't give labels to. I'm sorry.
That's a good point.
We're just Jews. I'm trying to be as Jewish as I can, right? Put everybody on that same line of, right? Some are more challenged at it, less challenged, right? Some, what do you call it? You can call it halachically challenged, right? There's some who are more halachically challenged and some who are less halachically challenged. So we're all on the same spectrum, though. Yeah.
Do you think we're more unified now as a people than we were at the time that we lost the temple because we were not unified?
That's
an interesting question.
That's something that the Maharal of Prague deals with directly. The Maharal asks about the story of the destruction of the temple. It says this because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the temple was destroyed, and tells a story there about a person who was thrown out of the party. And his name, the person who was thrown out of the party, was Bar Kamsa. But the Talmud says it's because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. What did Kamsa do wrong? So the Maharal explains that a Kamsa is a little creature who lives in his shell and has no society. And so, or he says it could be like the grasshopper that has no king. It's just a mass of creatures that all fly together. Either way you look at it, it was a description of society at the time, he said. The only thing that unified the Jews was geography. They're living in the same country together. And what God wanted was to bring out the true unity of the Jews, their true oneness. And the way to do that was by spreading them to all four corners of the earth. And even as we are spread everywhere throughout the world, we still remain one nation. Now, as critical as you can get, because we've always been very self-critical, there's no nation in the world that approaches anything near this type of unity of the Jewish people. Nothing close to it. Nothing close to it. That when a couple of teenagers in Israel are kidnapped, you have Jews over the entire world. And it doesn't matter what label they took for themselves, are praying for these kids. Okay? And we argue with each other, and we fight over each other, but we're still Jews. And I can walk into any part of the world. I can find a minion over there and walk in and be part of this thing. So this is an amazing unity that we have, and the Golus, this exile, brought out this unity much, much, much more. I think it's amazing. I think it's beautiful. I can walk into Pico. As soon as we moved into our place, we're just walking up the steps. The lady from across the street comes over and says, "Welcome to our neighborhood. If you need any shopping, I'll show you around." And all sorts of, we have a community immediately, snap, just like that. Nobody else in the world has community like the Jewish people have community. Nobody. Shabbos creates community. Kashrus creates community. Sending your kid to Jewish school creates the community. These things create community. You know, I think that God wanted to see his children twice a day. So therefore he told us, I want you to pray to me three times a day, and you have to come together to do it, right? People complain, they're talking in shul, they're talking in shul. I said, look, the main thing is they're here. We're together. God loves to see us together. Wherever we're together, that's great. So I think, yes, it's an amazing, whatever complaints you have, it's amazing unity we have today that has never existed before.
So diaspora is necessary?
Lo bara kadosh baruch hadavar ba'olamo levatala. God didn't create anything for nothing. Whatever happened has a reason behind it. That's the reason. By the way, in the early days, pre-internet days, I remember CompuSurf. You'd go online and you see where the discussions happening today. And there are the Christian forums, the Muslim forums, and the Jewish forums. And most of the days, there was more discussion on the Jewish forum than on the Christian and Muslim forum combined. Today on the internet, it is so Jewish. Our site happens to be the busiest faith-based website of all websites. There's no Christian website that approaches it. So it's amazing that this community, we've made the world into a global shtetl. And Jewish commerce, Jewish business is just the way Jews do business throughout the entire world. We've got this network and so on. And I mean, that's how the whole thing started, with the Jewish banking system. I was going to point out something very interesting. I was going to put it in the talk, but I decided to leave it out. But maybe I'll say about it now. What's brought tremendous wealth to the world today, especially post-Second World War, and especially since the falling of the Iron Curtain, is world commerce. So it hasn't been foreign aid anywhere near as much as world commerce. World commerce started off with the Rothschilds. The times of Napoleon, we were able to put money on paper and move huge amounts of money from one part of Europe to the other, just having it on paper, promissory notes, because it was a system of trust. And even throughout the Dark Ages, after the fall of the Roman Empire, when everything else had fallen apart, Jews were able to move goods from China to the Iberian Peninsula and back again and all around. Wonderful to see you. Too bad you have to go.
I have to get it's an hour to
home. Hope to see you again next week.
See you next week, Brad.
Yeah. Where did Jews get this idea? Why were Jews able to move money? Because Jews kept money on paper. They just wrote notes. And it was built on a system of trust. Why was it that Jews of all people were writing things on paper? It hit me. The reason is because in the Torah forbids taking interest. Since the Torah forbids taking interest, therefore, the rabbi said, whenever you borrow or sell or make any, you have to write it down. Otherwise, you could end up taking more than you gave. You could end up taking interest by mistake. So therefore, everything needs to be written down. So since everything was written down, Jews got used to this thing. You know, everything is written down, therefore they make worldwide commerce. And so it could be that we owe international commerce today to the issur ribis, the prohibition against taking interest. Okay? It's just a theory. Yeah. Anybody feels they need to leave or want to buy a book, it can go ahead. I'll keep on taking questions. Go ahead, yeah?